Welcome to episode 15 of the Close Range Hunter podcast. And in this episode, it's going to be a recap of my archery deer season. And spoiler alert, I got one. So let's start at the beginning, which actually was a really long time ago. I've talked about this on a previous podcast, but briefly summarizing my obsession with coos deer, I started getting into hunting coos deer with a bow in about 1992, I believe. And that year I actually shot one that jumped the string, which I didn't really realize till the next year when we looked at the video, and it had dropped as I shot, and the arrow went through the skin on top of the spine, you know. So I was really discouraged that I thought I had blown the shot, and it wasn't until over a year later that we actually looked at the video and saw what had happened. I'm like, oh man. Well, so that was the beginning of my interest in trying to get a coos deer with my bow. And over the years, I've watched them jump the string a few more times. I won't get into all those details, but in 1996, I killed a buck with my recurve bow sitting on a tree stand on a water hole, and it was a little 3x3 buck. I don't think it would even make the Pope and Young minimum of 65 inches. It would be close, probably, but I was super happy to get it. And going back a little bit, in 1993, I found some really huge coos deer sheds, and that got me really obsessed with trying to kill a big coos deer with a rifle or with a bow. And I spent a lot of time sitting water holes, sitting salt licks, spot stock hunting for several years. And, you know, I had kids. Let's see, my first daughter was born in 98, my second one was 2001. And I was guiding at the time and spent a lot of time in the woods and really obsessed with it. And when the kids were little, you know, I was spending more time with them. I stopped guiding basically in 2002 or something like that, got a real job. And I ended up not hunting as seriously, archery deer hunting as seriously, but I was fortunate enough to draw a lot of archery elk tags. And so I was averaging an archery elk tag every other year. And so I was putting a lot of time into that. But in 2006 is when I found this really big buck that was pretty much only huntable during archery season. It's just too thick to rifle hunt it in glass and stuff like that. And I put a bunch of years into hunting that giant buck as he got bigger every year. And I've told that story before too, but he finally died of old age in 2013. And I had put so much of my obsession into that one buck that I was just kind of really crushed that I never got him. And I kind of decided to quit trophy hunting. I decided to quit using trail cameras. I decided to quit bow hunting for coos deer. I was still hunting elk and everything else with a bow. But I went back to rifle hunting coos deer because I pretty much didn't rifle hunt from 2006 until I think 2014 or 15, because I was just trying to kill a big one with my bow. And, you know, using a stick bow about half the time. I prefer to stick bow hunt, but I'll use whatever, as I've said before. So I started killing some pretty nice deer after 2015 when I started rifle hunting again. I thought, man, this is awesome. I don't have to sit in a tree stand all the time or in a blind or whatever. And I was doing some spot stock hunting in those earlier years too, and actually got really close to several bucks, and just, you know, how bow hunting is, didn't work out. But you know, I finally kind of got, I killed a couple Boone and Crockett bucks and kind of got the trophy hunting thing going again, and at the same time kind of got over it too. So I mean, I shot 130 inch non-typical one year, and the next year I shot a buck that's probably about 70 in the same exact spot, just because it seemed like that was the buck to shoot that year. So kind of got over the obsession with killing a giant, but I still wanted to kill a really nice one with my bow. And so probably, I guess, 3 years ago, I think, so that'd be 2021, I put a little more effort into it, started, you know, checking old tree stands and stuff like that that I'd hunted before. And that was about the time they banned trail cameras, so I really haven't seen any trail camera photos of anything since about then either, which is kind of nice, because the problem is the trail cameras give you this false hope, and you go, oh yeah, I'm going to kill this giant buck. And then if you really look at the data on the trail cameras, you find out that buck only comes in once every 2 weeks, you know. And so your chance, if you're just hunting the weekends, is not very good. So shout out to my buddy Lance down in Tucson. Lance, former Border Patrolman. Lance's job with Border Patrol at the end was running the trail camera system with thousands of trail cameras out there, and he was getting pictures of jaguars and ocelots and giant coos deer and lots of illegals and drug runners and all kinds of other stuff on his trail cameras. But one time he was chasing some drug runners in this canyon. I guess he probably did it multiple times, but he kept jumping coos deer bucks in this canyon, and he thought, man, maybe I need to hunt here. And so he put up some tree stands and put out some salt licks and put some stands on some springs and stuff like that and started hunting. And I think that was probably about 7 years ago that he started hunting that. And he kept saying, oh, you need to come down here, not with me. You need to hunt with me. So about 3 years ago, after hunting a few days up here, I went, up here being northern Arizona, I went down to border country. Lance just listened to his first podcast ever. He told me, which was just a few days ago, which was my podcast. And he said, if I'm close range hunter, then he wants to be border hunter. But anyhow, he has some really good tree stands. They're very close to the border. And the way he found them were these illegals and drug runners and stuff are coming through. Makes them a little bit sketchy. But anyhow, he and another guy have been sitting these stands for about 7 years. And one particular stand, they've killed 7 bucks over 100 inches between the two of them, and plus some smaller bucks. And so I went down. I sat that stand a day or two that first year down there. Sat another stand, and wind was bad. I did have a buck come in. I had a lion come in, but I had shot a lion the weekend before, which was pretty exciting. That's the one I shot with my longbow, called in and shot it about 5 yards. And the lion that came in was a big old tom, but I couldn't shoot it because I'd filled my lion tag already. But I had one buck come in, and I shot at it, and it jumped the string. And just because of the weird shot angle on it, you're shooting almost straight down on this thing. And it was facing at me. So I aimed right between the shoulders, but as it dropped, the arrow actually hit it in the hip and didn't get really good penetration. Anyhow, another lost coos deer. I tracked it. It didn't really bleed very much. Tracked it a mile and a half, you know, with tiny blood and a few and footprints and things like that, and finally gave up on it and came home. So last year I went down there again. Last year was super wet monsoon, and sat between stands at that particular spot and another spot on the opposite side of the mountain range. I think I sat 12 days, passed up quite a few bucks, and some once again that I probably shouldn't have passed up, but I was looking for that monster. I got the stupid trophy hunting thing going again. And at one stand I was sitting with my stick bow because the shots were going to be pretty close, you know, 15 to 20 yards, but the other stand I would sit with a compound because the shots were going to be more like 20 to 30 yards. And my limit with a stick bow is about 20, 25 yards. And I just, you know, I love shooting a stick bow, but I'm a hunter first and a stick bow shooter second. And it would be kind of irresponsible for me to be sitting there and tempting myself, if I get a 30-yard shot, to take it with a stick bow. And I would rather not be sitting there day after day after day hoping for a shot and only to find that I've got the buck of my lifetime sitting there at 30 yards and I can't shoot it, or I'm going to, you know, make a bad decision and try to shoot too far. So So I sat with the compound on that stand, and I think I told that story before too, but on the very last day, I had $4 come in, and there was a giant one in there, 105, 110 buck for sure, and he never stopped, and I didn't get a shot after 12 days of hunting. And I could have killed one of the other bucks that came in before him, but I saw that buck back there, and I thought, oh, that's the one, that's the one. So fast forward to this year, and I was out a little bit this summer checking street tree stands and things like that in northern Arizona, and pretty much planned on hunting up here. Lance said that the illegal traffic, and when I say illegals, this area is not where your average person that wants to get a job working in a restaurant or doing stucco comes across the border. These rugged mountain ranges are where the bad guys come across the border. They're hiding. They're trying very hard not to get caught. And they're hauling fentanyl, meth, you know, all kinds of stuff. And so Lance said that the traffic was all-time high. Now, he's not Border Patrol anymore. He actually has another federal law enforcement job. But he still has lots of connections with people in Border Patrol. And so I was like, man, I don't know if I want to go down there. And he wasn't going to hunt opening weekend. And so I was like, well, maybe I'll just hunt up here opening weekend. I had a couple pretty good tree stands. When I say they're good, again, I don't have trail cameras, but there's, you know, lots of deer sign. And so I thought, well, I could go sit those. But, man, the access is just so terrible. It's almost faster for me to drive down to southern Arizona and hunt than it is to get into some of these rugged, remote places that I've got tree stands set up here in northern Arizona. So I kind of decided, you know, I talked to Lance on the phone again, and he said that they were going to show up. He and another guy were going to show up on, I think, Sunday night. And I thought, well, I can probably stomach 3 days alone. And he actually set up his camp and everything. So, oh, you can go stay in my camp. He goes to the tree stand. So then the last minute, his wife actually got sick. He was supposed to be doing something else and with her. And so he ended up showing up Sunday morning because she couldn't go off to do whatever they were going to do. But I sat the 100-inch buck stand for 2 days. Just the only bucks I had come in were a couple little spikes, which I had a lot last year. I was having a lot of like little spikes and button bucks come in with does. And then the mature bucks would come in together. And it seems like, you know, they're outnumbered about 4 or 5 to 1, but anyhow, nothing I wanted to shoot. And then since he was coming in, I decided to go sit this other stand, which I had scouted out. I got down there on Thursday and I'd scouted it out, and there was a lot of sign there. And so I thought, well, I'll go sit that stand. But we had to redo a few of the stands. There were a couple other stands that the one of them, that there was just no stand there. And the other stand was just in terrible shape. And so we moved it and did a bunch of work. And so I didn't really get to the tree stand until like 10 in the morning or something like that. And there was already a bunch of deer sign there. And so I sat that day. So that would have been Sunday. So Friday and Saturday, just saw some spikes and button bucks. And I think I saw 4 does on Friday. On Saturday, I saw 4 does and those 2 little spiky button bucks. And then on Sunday, I had, I think, 3 bucks came in. The biggest one was a 2x3. It was a pretty good size 2x3. It's probably 80-inch buck. But I decided this year, I'm not going for the Boone and Crockett buck. I'm going for a mature buck, mature 3x3. I told myself, you know, 85 inches or better. And then after a while, I was like, oh, maybe I want 90 or better. The trophy hunter started crawling back in there. But when this 2x3 came in with a couple of smaller bucks, I'd had no problem not picking up my bow to shoot him. And so that day was just doe mosh pit. So this particular spot, there's a small water hole there, and there's a salt lick there, and they were coming in and fighting. I had, at one point, I had 7 does below me, and this tree stand's only about 12 feet up in a tree, and to the front edge of the water hole, it's only about 15 yards. And these deer were just going crazy. These does are mean, man. They fight. They'll be, a doe will come in with a couple of, you know, smaller fawns or yearlings or something like that, and she will just chase all the other ones away. So she's the only one getting a drink or getting the salt or whatever. And then after a while, here comes another doe, and that doe will come in, and her fur will get all bristled up, and the other one will be bristled up, and they put their ears down, and they're kicking at each other. I mean, I got a picture of two does standing on their back legs boxing each other. But they kick each other and knock fur off of them. And you see that, you look at these does, and they've got like fur missing on their sides and stuff. And I think it's from getting kicked by other does. They're so dang mean. And so I, at one point I was pinned down on Sunday for 2.5 hours with just the doe mosh pit going on for 2.5 hours straight. And I was getting hungry and thirsty, but I'm so close to them that I really didn't want to move. And so finally I had maybe half an hour where there was no does around. So I got a drink and ate something real quick. And then pretty soon they started coming back, and it was just action all day. I mean, if I counted all the different deer that came in, there was probably 30 does that came in, but I know some of them came back 2 or 3 times. So maybe I had 12 or 15 different does that came in, but I've never seen action like it. It was, and they were just running around and chasing each other and fighting. And you could see a new doe would come in and she'd be bigger or meaner than the other doe, so she'd run that one off, you know. And then the littler ones, the subordinate ones, would end up fighting each other around the perimeter of the water hole, you know, trying to establish their pecking order. And so it was quite interesting to watch, but it's tough when you just can't move for, you know, most of the day because you don't want to spook them, because you never know what's lurking, you know, in the trees. At this spot, there is a chance for a shot up to 30 yards. And so I did end up with my compound bow in the stand. But a lot of the deer come in right next to the stand. I mean, within 5 or 10 yards of the stand, and they're coming from behind on this hill, which usually, you know, there's some leaves and stuff. Usually you can hear them coming, but sometimes they come in pretty silently. And others come in, you know, more of the distance, but you can only see, you know, some, you can see partially maybe out to 50 or 60 yards, but for the most part, you only see about 30 yards, in some places less than that. And so they can be on top of you, you know, really quickly before you know what's going on. So that was a kind of a long day. And Lance went and sat another stand that's been real good for bears. I don't know. I think he's killed a bear off of it. I know another guy's killed a bear off of it, but no bears came in while he was sitting there. So I just waited there until he came out about right before sunset, and we hiked back out. So that was Sunday. And then Monday, try to remember how this all works. Oh yeah, so Sunday night, his buddy showed up. His buddy, Mark is his name. He's a Border Patrol guy, and he has never shot a deer with a bow. He shot a antelope in Wyoming. He shot a javelina, but still kind of a beginner. So he was saying, you know, he'd shoot, you know, spike or a 2x or whatever, you know, he just wanted to get one. So Lance had put up a double set at the 100-inch stand. And so they sat there on Monday. Let's see how this works. Yeah. And then I went back to the one with the doe mosh pit on Monday. I'm already getting the days confused. It's been a week, almost a week, I guess, since I was there, but I've been just busting my butt around the house, doing house work on the house and all that. So I kind of lost track of the days here. But anyhow, so I went back there, and this particular stand, Lance says he doesn't usually worry about getting in there till 8 in the morning or something like that. I like to get in earlier than that. And this stand, I was getting there about 7:15 in the morning, and there was already deer sign on it every day. And it was raining every day too. I guess I should have pointed that out. On that Sunday, the little water hole filled up pretty good, and it's not very big, but throughout the day, the does probably drank 2/3 to 3/4 of the water in this water hole. I have never seen animals drink so much. And I took some pictures, and I later sent them to my daughter, I think, and she said, they look so round. I'm like, their bellies are full of water. I mean, I watched them drink, you know, this water hole down like 6 inches. It was amazing how much they were drinking. So I don't know what was going on. There was, you know, it's been raining. It was lots of green vegetation down there, but they were really tanking up on the water. But it rained again, filled up again the next day. So I'm sitting there on Monday morning, and those had already been there. They weren't there when I got there, but there you could see fresh tracks and stuff. I assume it was does. But I got in the stand, and I hadn't been in the stand 5 minutes, and boom, here comes a bunch of does come rolling in. And it was the same kind of thing again. There weren't as many at one time, but it was just constant does coming through there. And I've never, like I say, I've never seen anything like it. Lance hasn't seen anything like that. I mean, he sees more deer down there than we see in northern Arizona. But there was something going on. This particular canyon was just full of deer at this point. And at the same time, the other stand, the 100-inch buck stand, that one wasn't very active at all. And usually that's the really hot one. And for what it's worth, nobody had ever killed a deer off of the stand that I was sitting. And that's partly because the wind is bad, I think. And so last year I actually moved the stand. I only moved it 20, 25 yards. But I think that made a big difference because of the way the deer come into this spot. And so I just got a little bit better wind, and man, they were just rolling in. And I did have, the three bucks that came in on Sunday, they came in for a while, but they winded me. And it seems like the bucks are more nervous than the does. Once the does start coming in there and start fighting, they're just going nuts. So I'm sitting there starting about 7:15, 7:30 in the morning. Boom, they're coming in. Some of them were the same ones I'd seen the day before. I just recognized the little scars on their sides or their necks or whatever. And I think some of them were new ones that I hadn't seen before, but it was the same thing, you know. So it's getting to be, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm hungry, thirsty. And so finally I had a little brief spell where I could sneak some food out of my pack and stuff. And when I set a tree stand, I have a like a fleece bag that I hang on the side of the tree stand. This one particular was a ladder stand, and so it had like armrest on it, so I could hang this there. And that way I can put some snacks in there, I can put my phone in there, I can put my little games. I have a little Yahtzee game that I play with my thumbs, you know, while I'm sitting there. So I have a nice quiet place to put that stuff. I don't have to get in my noisy pack while I'm sitting there, but I can get stuff out really quietly without a lot of movement, because it's just, I put it on the side of the stand that's away from where the deer are coming from. So I can reach, so usually that's on my right hand because I'm shooting off my left shoulder because I'm a right-handed shooter. And I set up my stand so I'm facing, you know, perpendicular to my likely shot, so I can easily shoot over my left, off my left side. And I have one of those kind of hinged bow hooks that comes out a couple of feet from the tree, so I can hang my bow right at with the handle, the grip, right at the level where I barely have to move my arm, and I can grab that grip and lift it up off of there. So minimum movement, minimum sound. And I practice all this stuff while I'm in the tree stand. When there's no animals around, I'll practice lifting it up. I'll practice moving around, make sure I'm not making a lot of noise. And the other thing I'll do is I visualize my shots. And I think that's really important for coos deer in particular, because they jump the string. And I've heard people say that if you shoot farther at them, they're less likely to jump the string. But I'm always shooting pretty close, even with the compound bow. You know, I've heard people say, oh, you get 40 or 50 yards and they don't jump the string so bad. But I'd rather shoot them closer and have a better chance, I think, of me not blowing it. But so what I do is I think about, I'm going to aim, you know, right by their armpit. So just a couple inches up from the brisket and in that armpit area, because they almost always drop when they jump the string. Even at close range, they're going to drop a little bit. I've had deer totally spin around at 20, 25 yards. It's amazing how nervous and how fast these deer are. So with all these does there, I'm looking at this one standing over there. I'm like, okay, it's that many yards away, and I'm going to aim right there. And I'm constantly visualizing my shot and going through it in my head, so that I don't have to think. And one of the reasons I don't like shooting a compound bow is there's too much thinking involved and too much moving around involved. You know, you got to get your release on the string, you draw the bow, you know, hopefully look at your level bubble, you know, looking through your peep sight, you pick the right pin, and then you put the pin on the spot you want to hit. But if you got a 20-yard pin and it's 25 yards, well, then you go, oh, I got to hold it a little high or whatever. And so there's a lot of thinking that goes on. And so at this particular spot, I know my distances really well. I checked that 1,000 times, so I don't have to think about that. So all the time I'm sitting there day after day, I'm going through the rehearsing the shot, visualizing the shot, memorizing the distances, practicing getting my bow off the hook, getting on it, getting my grip right and everything silently and as quickly and smoothly as possible. And by practicing, I can eliminate, you know, certain noises and stuff. Like I'll bring a roll of hockey tape with me, and if there's something that's making noise, I'll put hockey tape on it, you know, or I'll, you know, check, you know, my shooting lanes and go, okay, when I get down on the stand today, I got to remember to go over there and trim that little twig off because it's in a shooting lane, you know. And so I spent a lot of time planning. And when you have a lot of deer there in front of you, it gives you that opportunity to visualize those shots and stuff. So I'm sitting there, it's now like 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, okay, I'm going to get a little something to eat. And so I had some string cheese, you know, that you give to your kids and you pull the little strings off of it. If you don't have kids, you maybe haven't eaten string cheese. I don't know. I didn't know it was a thing until I had kids. And it's just kind of fun to eat. But I'll eat this string cheese, and I just to waste time and boredom, fight boredom, I'll pull off the smallest little strings off of this cheese, and I'll hold it in such a way that I can just, you know, barely move and just put it in my mouth. I'm holding it right in front of my chin because I'm always trying not to move around because something could come in silently and I don't want to be making a bunch of noise. And so I'm sitting there eating string cheese, you know, and thinking, and I had accidentally put on a dirty shirt in the morning. I don't care who you are, these nice synthetic expensive camo brands, you know, Kuyu, Sitka, whatever, those synthetic shirts stink if you sweated them. So for the first day, you're fine. But on the second day, it at least for me, it mixes with my BO and it smells like a corpse. And I was sitting there going, man, I can smell myself. As soon as the sun started getting on me, I'm like, oh, I can just smell that smell. It's like they get bacteria living in them. And they say, oh, scent reducing material and stuff. Well, that's because they know that stuff stinks. Well, I happened to be wearing one of these shirts. The day before, I'd worn cotton, and cotton doesn't stink so bad. But I thought I put on a clean one that morning. So I'm sitting there, and the sun's on me. I'm like, man, I stink so bad. Maybe I should run back to the truck and get a clean shirt and wipe down again, because I did have some deer that came in. And in the morning, this tree stands down the canyon. So in the morning, the air is going down the canyon gently, and the way the deer are coming in is downstream from me. And so they were picking up some scent, and so the deer were getting kind of spooky and acting sort of weird. And I was like, I'll just wait until the wind starts going back up the canyon as the sun gets higher in the sky. Oh, wait, you know, but if by noon it's still going down the canyon, I'm going to get out of my tree and I'm going to run back. And I figured it was going to be like an hour round trip if I hurried to change that shirt and use some scent wipes and stuff and try to get less smelly, because I know that bucks are more sensitive to smell than these does are. I don't know why, but they are. And I know these bucks aren't getting hunted, so it's not that, you know, there's a lot of hunting pressure this spot. We've never seen any other hunters there. And you'd think they'd be used to the smell of humans from all the drug runners and stuff coming through there. And that's something else I forgot to mention. When Lance finally showed up, he said that there had been two big chases up this canyon. There was one where they chased a truck with a bunch of guys in it, and then they got a load, they caught some drug runners with a load of meth up in this canyon the week before the season started. And so he said it appears that, because he's talking to the guys that are looking at the trail cameras, that traffic's way down. So the word got back to the cartels, hey, their Border Patrol is patrolling this particular spot, and so maybe you want to go somewhere else. And so we didn't have any traffic at all coming through there, no border traffic at all. It was actually quite nice, whereas in previous years, you know, there was tracks in the trail every day, and the trail we're walking on is trails made by illegals, you know, or by drug runners. And there's trash all over the place and stuff. And so there would be fresh tracks every day, every morning, every evening. You know, I was seeing fresh tracks and didn't see any this time, which was nice. I hauled out a bunch of trash, doing my civic duty, cleaning up after the border traffic. But you'd think these deer would be used to the scent of humans with the, I mean, there are actual trails that are made through these canyons by the drug runners mostly. And so they were still acting spooky. So I'm sitting there eating my string cheese. You know, it's getting close to 11, maybe 10:45. I'm like, yeah, I'll just wait till noon. By then, the wind will be going good. And it actually started getting pretty good again, but it was still pretty gentle. And so I'm sitting there, just finished my string cheese. I'm just kind of quietly sitting there listening real hard because the wind wasn't blowing very much, and so it's really silent. And I'm sitting in this tree, and just out of the corner of my eye, to my left, I see some movement, and I just gently turn my head, and directly below my tree stand, it couldn't have been 5 yards away, I see antlers. And I could just tell, I was like, oh, that's a shooter. And so it had to walk right under my tree stand, and there's a bunch of leaves blocking its view. So it worked perfect. I could just grab my bow, and as it was walking under me, I could move my bow to where I had a shooting lane. Because it's off to my left, it's mostly just all leaves and trees. And then the deer is walking the same direction I'm swinging my bow. And there were two does that were coming in behind this buck. And I looked over my shoulder and saw them. I just wanted to make sure there wasn't another buck with them. I go, oh, that's two does, okay. And so from the time I saw that buck, he only had to walk less than 10 yards to where he was going to be in the clear, maybe 15 yards. Where I was going to get a shot at him. And as soon as he cleared the leaves, I drew the bow and dropped the pin and shot. And I mean, he cleared the leaves and stopped, and all that rehearsing I had done and all the visualization and stuff, this was a very instinctive shot taken with a compound bow. It was, you know, thinking back on it, I can think about what I was thinking, but at the time I wasn't consciously thinking, okay, put the pin here, you know, shoot now, wait till he stops. None of that. It was all 100% automatic. And I always say one of the great benefits of shooting a stick bow is how fast you can get a shot off. But I don't think I could have got a shot off any faster with a stick bow than I did with this compound bow. And again, it's because I rehearsed everything. I had visualized everything. And so I had turned it into an instinctive situation. And so I saw that deer, he was walking right behind me. He walks out into the clearing, stops, I drop the pin on him and shoot. It took less than 10 seconds from the time I saw that deer till I shot it. And I remember now that I put the pin low in the armpit, just like I needed to do, because first off, he was at about 15 yards and I had a 20 yard pin. So I needed to aim a little bit low for that, and then I was expecting him to jump the string. And so I hit him, and it went through so fast. I didn't see the arrow pass through him, but he took his first leap going facing the same direction. So he's kind of going almost directly away from me now, because he came past my left shoulder, walked out to in front of me, and I saw blood come shooting out and right on it, right in a perfect spot, you know. And there's just a little dip where the drainage in this canyon goes by, and then it goes up a fairly steep hill on the other side, and there's a game trail on the other side. And so he blasted from an eye shot. He took off like lightning, dropped to that little dip and started up the other side and fell over dead. And I don't know how fast these deer run, but they run faster than people do. And he didn't make it 50 yards at a dead run. I have never seen an animal die so fast from being shot with a bow. I mean, I mean, it couldn't have been 2 seconds to where he stopped and died, or 3 seconds at most. But I heard him. I couldn't see because it's so thick there. But I heard him stop and then crash. I was like, I can't believe how fast that happened. I sat there last year, you know, well, combinations of spots for 12 days. And finally, on the last day, buck comes in. I don't get a shot. And I passed up these other shots and stuff that, you know, I probably should have taken. And so this time, first buck that came in that was a shooter, I told myself, you'll know it when you see it. And that's something I always say, whether it's elk hunting or deer hunting or whatever. It's what I tell my clients when I'm guiding. Look, if you see something that gets you excited, that's the one you want to shoot. And so this buck I just saw was a nice 3x3. And that was all I needed to see. And so after he ran off, I sat there thinking, well, I don't really need to sit here and wait a half hour. I know he just flopped over right there. So I kind of started packing my stuff up and everything. And then I started going through it in my head. And I start thinking about the antlers. I'm like, oh, that's like a, you know, 90 plus buck. You know, he's probably a mid 90s buck. Again, I didn't think about it at all coming in. I just go, that's a shooter. I'm not even going to look again. And I was pretty happy. I was like, you know what? That's the buck I was looking for. I wasn't looking for that Boone and Crockett buck. I wasn't looking for the you know, even the 100 inch buck. I was looking for a mature 3x3 velvet coos deer to break my drought, to get on the board again. And I knew I had it. And I, you know, you think I'd be like, yes, I finally did it or whatever. But it's not like I haven't had tons of opportunities in the past. You know, I could have killed a lot of deer in the last 25 years or whatever since the last time I killed a deer with my bow. And I've shot at a few and missed, and I shot at and wounded a couple too, which I am not proud to say, but that it happens. I almost felt more relief than joy on this thing. And I really don't like killing stuff. You know, I like hunting. I love hunting. When I'm not hunting, I'm thinking about hunting, wishing I was hunting. But a lot of times when I have an animal in front of me, I don't shoot it. I mean, I can't tell you how many bears I could have killed in my life or how many mountain lions I could have killed in my life. I've had lots and lots of close encounters with bears, especially. You know, the last elk tag I had, I walked away from four different, you know, gimme shot opportunities, three different gimme shot opportunities. But when you see the one you want, you shoot it and don't think about it. But I've killed enough animals and I've not killed enough animals. And I think that's more important. It's easy for me to pass stuff up that when I do shoot one, I don't get overjoyed like you see guys in the hunting videos, like, yeah, man, and all that stuff. I'm happy, and, you know, I was smiling, but I just kept saying, I can't believe that happens so fast. You know, like I say, well under 10 seconds from the time I saw the deer till I shot it, and then a couple more seconds, and it's laying there dead. I was just like, wow, I'm back on the board again. I did what I, you know, came to do. And honestly, I could kill a deer every year out of one of these stands if I wasn't, you know, being super selective. I could have killed one of those three bucks that had come in the day before. Could have killed one of the spikes on the other day. But, you know, I kind of set my goals and I wasn't even looking at the size of this buck except say, nope, that's a mature buck. That's what I'm going to kill. And so I packed up my stuff. I just waited like 10 minutes, packed up my stuff, got down, and you know, you could see where that first splat of blood came out, but then I was like, man, there's no blood trail here. And, you know, I'm actually having to look pretty hard to find blood. And I was like, okay, there's a couple drops and there's a couple drops. I'm like, I know I hit him good. I saw the blood coming out of his side and I know he fell down up here because I heard him. He stopped running and then I heard him crash because it's all leaves on the side of this hill. I'm like, okay, well, just in case, I put an arrow on the string and I walked another 10 yards and I could see him laying there. And from where I hit him to where he died, it's under 50 yards. And at a dead run, it couldn't have been a couple seconds at most for him to get that far. So I was really happy that he went down fast and never knew what hit him. And so I, you know, it was 11 o'clock in the morning on the fourth day, and I was done, and I was really happy. The antlers were almost completely hard. In fact, when you touch the velvet around the bases, you could feel all the little bumps and stuff, and you could feel the grooves where the veins are and stuff, and the tips were pretty pointy, not real bulbous like they are early in the season. And so I was like, all right, this is about all he was going to grow. And you know, it's not the velvet was pretty close to the bone. And so I was like, he was going to start shedding pretty soon. One of the points on the right antler, the G3 on the right antler, I think it is, has some white on it. I don't know if that's where the skin on the velvet was starting to die and stuff. So he was pretty close. So I was like, man, this is great, you know, because that's another thing that I hate, broken points on animals. It just breaks my heart. I feel the same way about tattoos on girls. It just breaks my heart. I don't like anything. I like things in their natural state. I don't like them damaged. I don't like, you know, if they're not all grown out in velvet. I'm like, oh man, you know, that deer still had so much to grow. I want it to grow all the way out, you know, but this was like, it was perfect. And I'm telling you, I am the master of bad luck. My friends will tell you, it's like, I can have the perfect hunt and something will go wrong. I mean, this bull I shot with my longbow several years back was like the best shot I've ever made previous to this one, I think. Well, that was a 40 yard shot with a stick bow, but that bull, he went, didn't go 50 yards and tipped over dead, you know, in sight. And then when I'm skinning him out, I stab myself in the knee. I'm like, come on, can't I just have one hunt that's drama free? And this was it, you know. I mean, I kept waiting, like, okay, don't cut yourself when you're skinning this thing out, you know, and try to, you know, just be smart about this. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to probably run into a drug runner coming down the canyon or something like that, you know, but I kind of got PTSD about stuff going wrong on my hunts. But anyhow, I took some pictures, tagged it, started skinning it out and quartering it up. And took me about an hour to get it skinned and quartered. And I go pretty slow. I try not to cut myself, and I wasn't saving the cape on this because their summer capes are pretty awful. And I usually just do Euro mounts and stuff. So anyhow, I didn't have to save the cape, but I try to keep everything, the meat, real clean and stuff, and make sure I get as much meat as I can off it. So it took me about an hour, and I had all my meat laying. As I've said before, I bring these cheap ponchos that you can buy, you know, at Walmart or whatever. I use that as a ground cloth. Sometimes I'll put it under the animal, but I always will use that to put my meat on, just lay my meat out. And I was only using it's a Badlands Super Day pack, which is not really big, and I'm filling it. I can't believe I'm going to sit in a tree stand. I'll fill that pack up every day. Now, some of it is I wear a safety belt. I use a actual rock climbing harness. That's just an old climbing harness I have. I don't like the ones that go over your shoulders and all that kind of stuff. But and I have my little fleece bag and my games, and I bring an extra battery for my phone. So I fill that pack up going to go sit in a tree stand. And I'm like, man, I'm going to have to hike out of here, go back, get my frame pack, come back, and pack this thing out. And I was like, you know, this buck isn't very heavy. I didn't want to damage the velvet when I was doing stuff, so I wasn't really handling the horns. I was trying to keep him off the ground, and so I was picking him up by his neck and his back legs to move him to where I had a better spot to skin him. And I was like, this thing weighs about the same as a bag of concrete, you know. It's like 100 pounds max or something like that. And so I had all that meat sitting there, and I was like, you know what? I bet I can get this out in my Super Day pack. And one of the things I also do in my pack is I have a stuff sack that I put my food in, and it's a pretty good sized stuff sack, not big enough to put a sleeping bag in, but almost. And then I have my little fleece bag, and I have my camera that's in a waterproof dry bag. But I do this so that if I need to, I can tie all that stuff in a bag on the outside of my pack, and I can use that food bag to put a lot of the miscellaneous other stuff that's inside the pack. I have a kill kit that's in a little stuff sack that's, you know, maybe a little bigger than a grapefruit or cantaloupe size or something like that. And so I can put a bunch of stuff in that, and then I can hang those on the outside of my pack and put all the meat on the inside. So that's what I did. I have a big old, my big old, you know, contractor grade trash bag. I take everything out of the main compartment of the pack, put that in there, and then start putting the meat in. And you know, I didn't debone it. And so I had hind quarters, front shoulders, back straps, neck meat, some rib meat, and the tenderloins. And I put all that in there. I have to kind of shake it down to get everything to go down to the bottom. And then I tie that other stuff on the outside. I had a seat pad. I'm trying to remember all the crap I had. And then that pack, it just has zippers to close. And so I have the legs sticking up out of the top. So to keep the zippers from opening up and the stuff from falling out, I put some 550 cord through some of the not really molly loops, but kind of on the pack, and then up to the like the thing that goes between the shoulder straps where you could hang it on a hook or something like that. So that, and I put the legs between that, and I tied all the legs together with some of the 550 cord too, so they're nice and tight where the, you know, the lower legs parts are sticking up, and then put that around those, and that keeps the, because the zippers zip down the sides and it could just flop open. So that keeps everything up and tight. And then I hang all the other stuff on the outside of the pack. And so I got it all in there and just had to make one trip back out. And it, you know, when I packed off of my deer 2 years ago that I shot with a rifle, I was on a llama pack trip. And on a llama pack trip, you bring a scale so you can weigh the panniers and balance them. And so I was able to weigh all that. And counting my rifle and my tripod, my spotting scope and all that crap, I had 85 pounds with the deer head, deer meat, pretty much the same way. On this one, I probably didn't, you know, I didn't have the spotting scope, I didn't have a tripod, and I think it was a smaller body deer, and so I probably had like 70 pounds or something like that. It wasn't too bad hiking out with that. I did almost step on a rattlesnake on my way out, which was kind of surprising because it was pretty cool, and up in the mountains, it had been raining and stuff. So anyhow, got it packed out and then got back to camp, and it was probably, I don't know, 2 PM or something. I got back to camp and hung up the meat in the shade and the back straps and stuff. I laid them out on the poncho on the ground in the shade, and just let everything cool off for a little bit, and then skinned out the head, the face. And again, I wasn't saving the cape, but I skinned the face out. And then I used that, what do they call it? Velvet Antler Technologies, Velvalock. I bought some of that. I thought I was jinxing myself when I bought that beforehand. But I have a friend who, he went to Alaska with his cousin. His cousin has shot two velvet caribou up there and used that stuff. And it worked really well. So I thought, well, I'll give it a try. So I skinned the face out. I wanted to get all that off of there, and then sprayed it down. Got all, as much meat as I could off of the head. Sprayed the velvet down, and they say leave it in the sun and leave the points pointing straight up. So that's what I did. I put it in the sun, and then I went to work on my meat and getting it all in the ice chest with ice. Lance was nice enough to bring extra ice when he came in, and got it all iced down. And I thought, man, I got plenty of time this afternoon. Maybe I should go hunt bears. And then Lance and Mark came back. They kind of came back from the stand early. They didn't see anything that day. And they were taking a nap in the tent. And so I was like, I'm going to go up and go hike to that bear stand and see if I can see some bears in there. So I took off. And it was, by then it was kind of hot. It was afternoon. It was 4 PM. It was, you know, it seemed hot. It was probably 85 or something like that, but the sun was beating down. And so I go take off to go hike up this canyon. It's right to this particular tree stand. It's on a spring. It's probably a mile and a half, maybe. And I get there, no bear sign at all. I think the bears vacated this area. This area is more juniper berries and acorns, but the prickly pears down lower elevation had ripened up. I think the bears mostly just vacated the place to go eat prickly pears, is my guess, because usually there's quite a bit of bear sign there. Again, it's so thick, you'd never glass up anything. The only way to hunt is sitting in a tree stance. But so I just like, I'll just turn around, hike back, and then thunderstorm comes in, and we are getting storms in the morning and getting storms in the afternoon. The afternoon storms are always more intense. And so I'm like, oh, I left my rack sitting on top of my truck. And I did that because I wanted it to be in the sun, but I didn't want to leave it on the ground where some rodent or something was going to get it. And I didn't tell those guys. I was going to tell them, hey, if it rains or something, or if you hear ravens out here, put my rack in the back of my truck. So I'm like, oh, I got to get back before my rack gets rained on, because I don't know what happens with that Velvalock stuff, if it washes off or something. But it just downpoured. And so I got back to camp right about the time it really cut loose. I got the rack off top of the truck, and Lance puts up a big old awning that's big enough you could park a pickup truck under it. We don't do that, but we have table and chairs and stuff under there. And the three of us stood in that thing, and we were getting soaked just from all the spray, because, I mean, it was raining so hard. There was actually a stream going under the tent, and we're using a 12 by 12 Cabela's, I think they call it the Outback Lodge. Really good tent, never leaks. I have one. I've had two in the past. I got the newer model. Lance has the newer model. They work great. They're way cheaper than a lot of the fancy stuff out there, but mine's been in the rain a ton, and Lance's has been in the rain a ton down there. And there was actually a stream going under the middle of the tent. Never got any water in it. And everything got soaked. I mean, we were getting soaked under the awning because just from the spray. It was such an intense thunderstorm, lightning and stuff. And so it finally passed. And so I'm like, well, what do I do now? And so now it's like 6 o'clock or 6:30 or something like that. So I take the rack and I kind of squeeze it with paper towels to kind of dry it off. And then I go start my truck, and I put the rack on the console of my truck and turn the heat on full blast coming out the vents to try to dry those antlers off, and let my truck run for like 45 minutes. And that Velvalock's supposed to work well with heat. It's supposed to be warm. I'm like, well, this should help. So and it smells like lemon pledge. When I smell it, I'm like, what is this smelling? It smells like furniture polish. So when Lance came out, I go, Lance, smell this rack. And he goes, smells like lemon pledge. I'm like, exactly. But it's really strong, so the inside of my truck got kind of lemon pledged out. But anyhow, I had it there and got it dried off, and then I sprayed it again. I didn't know if I needed to or not, but I'm like, I'll spray it again. And I had a 12-ounce bottle, and I really soaked it. You're supposed to really soak it down. It was just dripping off of the thing. And so that was that. And so the next morning, Tuesday morning, one thing I forgot to mention, the 100-inch buck stand had been struck by lightning before the season started, but Lance had been there just a couple days before, and it hadn't been struck by lightning. But when I got there on Friday morning, that tree had been hit by lightning. There was bark all over he had two tree stands set up there. There's bark all over the seats and stuff, and there was sap coming out. And you could see where the bark blew off the side of the tree as the lightning came down the tree, and it stopped where the bow hook was screwed into the tree. It's a bow hook with a foldable arm. And the bow hook was just kind of hanging there, like it almost got blown out of the tree. But you could see the bark it's pushed out like it blew up at this where the screw goes into the tree. And that was the termination of the lightning bolt, was that where that thing was screwed into the tree. And it didn't go any farther down the tree. It was really cool. But the thing wasn't damaged at all, but the hole was black, like it had gotten super hot, but it didn't burn. So we'll see if that tree dies or not. But there was sap on everything and all that. But anyhow, so that we got lightning all around camp and that evening with that storm and stuff. So the next morning, you know, everything was wet. I'm walking up the canyon. I was going to go back to that bear stand and check that out, see if anything came in. And of course I got soaking wet walking through the brush and everything, and it was like foggy and misty. I felt like, I always think this place is kind of like the jungle. I mean, it's literally as close to Mexico as I'm ever going to get to hunt. I can't afford to hunt in Mexico. And so it's the most like Mexico hunting, and it is as close to the border about as you can get to. And I was like, this is like subtropical, tropical place. It's so much more rain because it's up in the mountains, you know, and all that. And it was just weird walking up this canyon. It was all misty and stuff. And I got up there, and sure enough, the deer had already been into where I'd shot mine, and the carcass was still there, and the turkey vultures had found it. They don't waste any time. But hiked up to the bear stand, and there just no fresh sign. I thought the bears might come to that carcass and, you know, smell the carcass smell going down the canyon, but they didn't come in. That's another thing that makes me think that they're just not there, because last year Lance shot his buck, I believe it was on a Monday, and I was there Tuesday morning at like 7 o'clock in the morning. His carcass was gone. Like there was, you couldn't tell it had ever been there except for some blood stains on a log. He goes, no, the carcass was like 15 yards away. You know, you can see it from the tree stand. I'm like, nope, not there. Bear hauled it off. So just not so many bears there. But anyhow, I was like, you know what? I think I'd probably just get home and get this rack dealt with and the meat dealt with and stuff. So I headed back to camp and loaded up and headed out. And Lance and Mark were still sitting, and I can't remember. I think they got rained out again. And then they sat the next day, and Mark ended up shooting a 2x3 buck. And I'm trying to think. At some point, there was another. Oh, Lance was there by himself. Mark took his buck into town. Lance was there by himself, and he was at camp, and lightning hit a tree, like, right in camp. He thought he was going to die. So, like, every evening, there were these really intense thunderstorms, and then sometimes we'd get a shower in the morning, too. So it's unlike hunting anywhere else in Arizona that I've been. And last year, I mean, it was – the creeks were running. I mean, there was a flash flood that I had to wait to get in there to cross these drainages because they were flash flooding so bad. This year is quite a bit drier, but it's still not like the rest of Arizona. So got home and cut up the meat the next day and left. You're supposed to let the Velvaloc cure for 72 hours. And so it was pretty warm here. Where I live, and so I just left it in the garage and let it cure, and it was just starting to get kind of stinky, and I thought, okay, now it's time to do something with this. So I actually emailed the Velvaloc guys, said, hey, I don't know if you boil out these, if you can boil with this stuff on here, but here's my plan. I'm going to put like Saran wrap around the antlers and then put aluminum foil over that. And they replied very rapidly, said, yep, that's exactly what you want to do. And he said, just make sure you get that plastic and stuff off the rack so it dries out again. I'm like, okay, got it. So that's what I did. And so the plastic wrap, I let it go down maybe a half inch below the burr, and I wrapped, you know, one wrap of plastic wrap, and then it kind of sticks to itself and gets bunched up. And so then I kept wrapping it, so I had multiple layers there, and wrapping it pretty tight up to the eye guard. And then I put a zip tie at where it went below the burr. I zip tied it real tight to try, because I'm going to pressure wash this thing. I'm going to boil it and pressure wash it. And I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to accidentally hit it with the pressure washer and then blow that plastic off there. And there goes my velvet. So then I wrapped the whole rest of the antlers with the plastic wrap also, but not as tightly. And then I wrapped aluminum foil. So the base, again, I put, because that's where you're going to be the nearest to the boiling water. So I put several layers of the aluminum foil down around the base up to the eye guard. And then the rest of it I wrapped quite loosely just so that it will, the aluminum foil won't be sitting right on the velvet. It'll be reflecting. I put the shiny side out because that's going to be more reflective of the heat. And then that I used hockey tape to tape that down, because hockey tape does better in water and stuff than, say, electrical tape or something like that. So with hockey tape, but I put that right above the burr to hold the aluminum foil on, and just a couple wraps between the burr and the eye guard. And then I put a piece of plywood on the ground and put a cinder block on it and used baling wire to tie it to the cinder block so that it wouldn't move around, because I don't want this velvet. I don't want to be blowing the thing around, have the velvet get damaged just from falling. I boiled it for half an hour with the water just at the top of the skull cap, and then I put in some Dawn dish soap to try to break up the grease a little bit. But I would have boiled it more, but I was like, I don't know how long I can boil that velvet, you know, without it start coming off the burr. So I boiled it for half an hour, and then I pressure washed it, and it came pretty dang clean. I was surprised, and the only issue, and I think this is because it's in velvet, and the way you put the antlers pointing up, I think the blood, whatever blood's remaining in that velvet, drains into the skull bones and into the skull, because it was much darker, the skull was much darker looking, and you could see that there was like little capillaries in the bones and stuff like that that had blood in them still. And I think that's just what happens when you have velvet, it's, and you put it up, it's, the blood's going to drain down into the skull. So I haven't got my peroxide treatment yet, but it came pretty clean considering I didn't boil it that long. I picked off a few things, you know, around the gums of the teeth and stuff like that. But once I was done with the pressure washer, I took the plastic and the foil off real quickly, and then again dried it with paper towels, just kind of gently squeezing it at the bases. That's the only place it really got damp. And then I used a brush that was a plastic bristle brush, but the bristles are fairly far apart and not real stiff, to fluff that velvet up around the burrs again. And it's sitting in my living room right now. The skull isn't real white, but doesn't smell. Velvet looks good. I think it worked. And so I'm not sponsored by anybody, but that Velvelock stuff seems to work. And you can boil out a velvet skull. I called my taxidermist, and he's an excellent taxidermist. I said, hey, do you have any tips on doing a boiling a velvet skull? And he says, I don't do it. And when he does do it, what he does is he actually cuts the antlers off, but he doesn't cut them off flat. He cuts them with a V so that they'll go in kind of like a lock and key kind of when he puts them back on. But he'll cut the antlers off, send them off to be freeze dried, then do the skull by itself. And then when he gets the antlers back, he drills holes, puts rods in there, and glues it back together and paints it all up. You could never tell he's cut the antlers off. I had no idea. But he says basically he doesn't do it. You know, he's that's what he's done in the past, but it's way too time intensive, and people don't want to pay that much for a euro mount, and so he doesn't do it. So if you want to do a euro on your velvet deer, try the Velvelock. So far so good, and the Lemon Pledge smell wasn't too offensive, and it went away. I mean, if you sniff it real close, you can maybe still smell a little bit, but it came out great. So I'm looking forward to getting some peroxide on it, getting it whitened up, but it looks good. And then I finally, once I had it all cleaned up and dried off, I finally measured it, and it measured 94 even. So it was about what I thought. It was mid-90s buck, and I'm real happy with it. It's going to go on a hook on the wall with my hardhorn bucks, and now I can think about next year. It's weird to not have deer season still open. Like I say, for a lot of years, I didn't really hunt deer, you know, like from 2012 until, you know, just a couple of years ago. I didn't even really hunt deer in August, except I'd carry my bow around when I was scouting for elk or something. But I was just got used to like, oh, it's deer season. I can go run out this afternoon and go look for something, and I'm done. And the season doesn't close for another week or something. So that's kind of a weird feeling, but I like it. And so now I got a year to think about it. I do have a rifle tag that I'm going to turn in to give away to some good organization. I don't know which organization needs it the most, but I'll ask about that. And, I have some guys to guide on a rifle hunt in the same area anyway, so I'll still get to go do that hunt. I just don't kill something myself. And yeah, so next year, what am I going to do? Am I going to go back to trophy hunting? I thought, heck, maybe I need to go try to kill a mule deer. I mean, the last time I shot a mule deer was 1998. I shot it with my bow. It was in December, and I always said, oh, I don't want to shoot a mule deer unless it's December when the season's almost over anyway. Why would I waste a tag on a mule deer, you know? I realize I'm in a minority, but that was a pretty cool hunt. My daughter was 6 months old. My first daughter was 6 months old, and we did a pack trip into wilderness area with our llamas, and I ended up shooting this deer right near camp. And when I say right near camp, I mean a couple hundred yards from camp. It just, that's the way it worked out. It wasn't there when I stalked it, but the way everything all worked out, I ended up shooting it right near camp. So I walked back to camp. I told my wife, I said, hey, I got a deer. Let's go over and take pictures. She's like, you're kidding me. I'm like, no, it's just right here. So we went over there, and somewhere I have a picture of my daughter, 6 months old, sitting between the antlers of this deer in her little fuzzy onesies because it was December. And I've been looking for that picture for a long time. I had a red beard in that picture, not a white beard, and she was 6 months old, and she's 25 now, and she just got married. So it's been a while since I've shot a mule deer, and maybe next year I'll try to shoot a velvet mule deer. We'll see, but I sure love these goose deer, and I really like the hardhorn ones too. I mean, I might be out in January trying to kill a hardhorn one. We'll see. But what's next? Well, it is still bear season in some places. The place I wanted to hunt bears closed already, but there's a couple places that might stay open for a little while that I'll get out to hunt bears, and some other places are going to reopen in October, so maybe I'll go do a little bear hunting. But bears, I feel the same way about bears, about coos deer. Like, I'm not just going to kill one to kill one. It's got to be the right situation. It may not, might be a big bear, it might be a average bear, maybe even a small bear, but when I see it, I'll know it. And so we'll see. Probably won't shoot one, but if I get a good one, may get a chance at a good one, maybe I will. And I think I might try spotting stalking again, because I was calling bears like crazy 5 years ago, and I haven't called one in since. And so I'm thinking maybe it's time to go back to spotting stalking bears, because I've had more success with that. At least spotting them and stalking them. I haven't shot them. Well, I shot one a long time ago, but I've had a lot of opportunities where maybe if I had been shooting a compound bow, you know, shooting out to 40 yards, I would have killed one. Had a couple of big ones that were shooters. I just was, you know, had my stick bow and they just weren't close enough. But like I say, I don't have to kill something to make me happy. There have been times when I didn't kill something, I was pretty unhappy about it, but that's another story. So yeah, no elk tag. We'll see. I got bears, maybe mountain lions, and go quail hunting. Going to do some llama trips here, and we've got a wedding reception for my daughter here at the house this Saturday. That's why I'm doing so much work around here, trying to get things looking somewhat presentable. So that's that. That's my deer hunt story. That's some tips on taking care of your velvet. And I want to say one other thing. This is a bummer, but the day after I got back from my hunt, that morning, a friend of mine died, and it was very unexpected. Still don't know exactly what happened, but this guy was one of the most unique, interesting, chill guys ever. I have a lot of really unique friends. Look up Old Man Lightning. That guy's my brother from another mother. They're making a movie about him. Look up the Old Man Lightning trailer for the movie. I have a lot of really strange friends and really interesting friends. It's one of the things I do in my life. I just like people that are interesting that I can learn something from, or they're very different from me. And this guy was very, very different from me. I mean, he lived in a tiny little stone house. His name was Ed Furbush. And Ed lived alone in a tiny little stone house. He had two motorcycles, two bicycles. He ran a one-man bike shop here in Prescott called Southwest Sounds and Cyclery. Bike shop is 6 feet wide by 20 feet long. He worked as little as possible. He'd kind of work Monday through Thursday, 9-ish to 3-ish, or something like that. Never had much money, never needed much money. Just super cool guy. Loved everybody. Everybody loved him. I've seen him. He'll build $10,000 bikes, you know, for the rich guy from California, and then he'll fix homeless guys' bikes for free. I've seen him give $5 to homeless guys, and I've seen homeless guys come back in and say, "Hey, I'll pay back." He goes, "No, you don't need to do it, man. It's cool, you know." Ed was kind of a Rastafarian. Now, he didn't look like a Rastafarian, but he was always playing the reggae music and the cool music in his store, and just absolutely most chill guy ever. And Everybody loved him up here. He was a fixture in downtown Prescott. His shop, people walked by it every day and didn't even know it was there. It was right by, just two doors down from the Hike Shack, right on the, it was on Montezuma Street. And people go, there's a bike shop there? Yeah, it's been there for 20 years. And Ed was a fixture. And and every time I shot something, I'd go bring him some meat. He didn't hunt, but he sure liked the meat. He'd call me sometimes. He'd be like, hey, I could use a little meat, man, And he'd also call me and leave messages that were just motorcycle noises because everybody knew him as a bike guy, but he and I talked motorcycles, and we were both kind of KTM snobs, you know. So I'd stop by the shop, and we'd talk dirt bikes or talk about motocross or supercross or off-road racing or the new bikes or whatever. But he'd leave me these phone messages. It was just, he'd be making two-stroke noises, you know. That would be the whole phone message, and it just always made me smile. And just an amazing dude. And it's the second friend of mine like this that you just thought, oh, that guy's going to live forever. And just suddenly gone. And I heard that he doesn't have any family or, you know, wife or anything here. And so everybody knows him, but it's like, who's responsible for Ed's stuff, you know, and who's going to take care of this? And it's just a really weird situation. And so I think I heard that he had had some problem with blood clots. I had heard that maybe he'd been in a car accident of some sort. Maybe that caused the blood clots. I don't know. I just talked to him. I bought a new motorcycle a month or so ago, and I rode it up to his house. He was the first guy I went to go show off my new motorcycle to, and we just hang out there for a while, and it's just such a shock. So remember, life is short. You never know when your time is up. You never know when your loved one's time is up, your friends. If you have somebody like, oh, you know, I've been meaning to give him a call or go visit or whatever, do it. Don't wait. You know, I've felt that way my whole life. And every time I went downtown, I'd look to see if Ed had the bikes out on the sidewalk because his shop was so small, he couldn't put bikes in the shop and work in the shop at the same time. So he had a bike rack that he put on the sidewalk, and he'd wheel the bikes out every morning, put the bikes out there. A lot of times he didn't even lock them up. You know, these were like customers' bikes that he was fixing. And nobody would ever steal a bike from Ed. And then in the evening when he was done, he'd move the bikes in, have his little tiny broom, he'd sweep off his doorstep, move his bike rack in, close the door. And I'll never go to downtown Prescott, and it'll never be the same again. You know, you always look down there and go, oh, Ed's bikes are out on the sidewalk. He must be in the shop. I'll go talk to him, you know. Sometimes we'd sit there for a couple hours and just talk about life. And I always appreciated it, never took it for granted. So make sure you treat everybody you care for that way. So I'll end on that. You know, just keep on keeping on, and don't take anything for granted. You only have so many hunting seasons left in you, you know, only have so many birthdays for your kids or whatever. So don't let it slide. So that's episode 15 of The Close Range Hunter. And we'll see. I was going to interview Lance for this one, but I ended up shooting a deer and didn't have time. So maybe I'll try to get Lance on here. And he's a real interesting character too. And maybe we'll see if we can get some of his tips for killing all those 100-inch bucks out of a tree stand. So until next time, shoot straight. Bye.